Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, our conversation will revisit the possibility of a Roaring Twenties style economy to take shape in the U.S., as we will spend some time reviewing the updated assessment of such a scenario from the UBS Chief Investment Office. Joining me here at our 1285 podcast studio in New York for the conversation, glad to welcome Jason Dreho, the head of asset allocation for the Americas, as well as Paul Shao, asset allocation strategist for the Americas, both from the UBS Chief Investment Office. So, Jason, Paul, thank you for dropping by the studio today here in 1285. Great to be with you both. Thank you for spending some time with our listeners and clients. Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Absolutely. So, Jason, maybe to set the stage a bit, provide some context. I know you and your team have been writing about the possibility of a roaring 20s U.S. economy for quite a while now. You did recently publish an updated assessment on this very scenario. So to begin, Jason, can you explain to us what you mean by a roaring 20s economy and how the economy is currently performing relative to that scenario?
So this is a scenario for the economy. It's not a marketing or market scenario. So you think of like the roaring 20s. And bubbles and things like that. This is about the economy. And so really the way we define a roaring 20s is where the U.S. economy is basically performing at a higher level than it was for the pre-pandemic decade. And like for quantifying it, we'd say, real GDP growth will average about 2.5% or better for the decade. Inflation will be between 2 to 3%. Let's say pick 2.5% as a midpoint, but in that range, the 10-year treasury yield stays around 4%, maybe even a little bit higher. And the Fed funds rate would be between 3 to 4%, all levels that are higher than they were for the 2010s, and kind of comparable to where they were in the 1990s and like the early 2000s. We're nearly halfway. We're at the halfway point of 2024, and it's hard to believe, but I can almost at the halfway point of the 2020s. The economic conditions are still very much in line with that. And we look at it. Just think about last year, real GDP growth was 2.5%, so bang in line. Consensus for this year is 2.4%. CPI inflation last year, 4.1%. This year, again, consensus is expecting 2.9%, so within that 2 to 3% range. The Fed funds rate is still on the elevated side. It's like 5.3% ended last year. We think the Fed will cut twice this year to get us down to about like 4.9%. So trending in that direction. And then the 10-year end of last year at 3.9, we're currently like around 4.25. We think it'll end around 3.85, 3.9. So again, sort of around the 4% range. So by kind of that criterion, this still looks like kind of a roaring 20s economy, the way we define it, at least.
Jason, thank you for that context. Paul, to welcome you into the conversation, it was interesting within the report, you do map the mega trends that you discussed in the early report to model for economic growth. So what's the purpose of doing this for evaluating a roaring 20s scenario?
That's right. And just to remind the listeners, so last time we did this report, one of the reasons why we're more confident that the U.S. economy would be operating on a higher level was the preponderance of the five megatrends, right? And the two, perhaps the most important that we're considering for this report is CapEx investment as well as AI investment. So this time when we're updating our assessment, our look at how the Roaring 20s scenario is doing, we actually dug up economic theory called the Solo Swan growth model that says growth is a function of technology, capital, and labor. And so by looking at these sort of three components, technology, capital, and labor, we can start assessing how possible is a structurally higher U.S. economy. So that's the lens we're looking at the U.S. economy for this report.
So, Jason, it was interesting. You came up with a bit of a scoring system known as the ROAR score to evaluate the likelihood of a roaring 20s scenario. So can you expand a bit as to what this scoring system is and what it's telling you about this possibility?
So to take what Paul described in terms of this kind of growth model, this kind of conceptual academic framework, to make it a little bit more practical, we figure like how do we map sort of these megatrends that Paul alluded to, CapEx boom, this AI story, into capital contributions, labor inputs, and sort of this kind of ephemeral kind of productivity component. And so that's really what the ROAR score, we're going to trademark that, by the way.
Sure.
You heard it here first. Yes. To sort of map it into, different factors that we think, to sort of quantitative, but kind of ultimately kind of qualitative assess, how likely is this to support a roaring 20s outcome? So for example, like a factor like large investment across the economy, that's kind of a capital input. A labor force growth that surpasses demographic trends, that's sort of a kind of upside surprises to labor supply. You know, AI adoption, rapid AI adoption, that's kind of both capital investment to build it up, but also could be productivity enhancing. And so when we kind of do these criteria, we kind of assess today versus last fall when we did the report, you know, on a 1 to 5 scale, where are we and have they sort of changed? And sort of basically across the board, we think they're still, we're as confident as we were last fall. In some cases, like labor supply has been kind of an upside surprise. That's sort of done better. I think on the productivity side, we see the data still show, you know, kind of strength. AI adoption investment seems to be, you know, like an, almost on the high side of our estimates. So kind of collectively, we'd say we're as confident, even more confident now of this fundamental sort of the foundations for a roaring 20s being laid versus last fall.
To tie in some domestic policy into the conversation, I know the report highlights a series of legislative items that have recently passed that in theory should be a boost to investment. How is that doing at the moment?
So when we're looking at different factors that could really make this a roaring 20s, one of the more encouraging things was having these pieces of fiscal stimulus passed. We're talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, as well as a bipartisan infrastructure law. And I think together that's around $2 trillion in spending from over the next decade. So it's a lot of money, and it's pretty significant from the fiscal side. What we're looking at is that while it has stimulated investment in pockets of the economy, for example, manufacturing for electronics has really shot through the roof, as well as investment for data centers, which is very much in line for our AI theme. Mm-hmm. Most of it has yet to be spent. For example, in the bipartisan infrastructure plan, which is about $1.2 trillion, around $600 billion has yet to be awarded or spent yet. So we think that this could be a long-term stimulus, and if it works well with the private sector, we're hoping that this will encourage not only just pockets of the economy to experience investment, but the overall aggregate to have a higher CapEx spending, which we think overall should be good for the supply side of the economy.
Another factor worth spending a few moments on, that being immigration, which is increasingly a hot topic, especially given that it's an election year here in the U.S. Can you, Paul, tell us why immigration matters when it comes to assessing the ROAR score?
Absolutely. And I think Jason alluded to this previously. But if you take the long-term view of not just the U.S. economy, but a lot of developed markets around the world, birth rates are declining. So going back to the model that we talked about, the Solis-Wan growth model, labor growth is something that is quite important. And we've had that slow down for quite some time. So it was quite surprising for us as economic and market watchers to see job growth be so robust over the last couple of years, but inflation continuing to slow down. And we finally have the answer to that mystery, which was the CBO saw millions more immigrants come into the country than previously expected, which can explain the higher levels of job growth, but with wage inflation declining. Now, you did mention that it is an election year, mm-hmm. and immigration is on the mind of the top two candidates. So it is worth saying that while immigration is a tailwind to the U.S. economy, some of the benefits might be limited based on any restrictions on working for these immigrants.
Jason said that the likelihood of a roaring 20s scenario has gone up marginally since last November 2023, but you guys also write about that policy is a wild card that could either increase or decrease the probability of this outcome. How so exactly?
Well, Paul already mentioned one on the labor side. You know, the policy implications could curtail immigration and therefore can curtail the labor input into this kind of growth model. When we look actually though at the overall sort of situation for the U.S. economy, I'd say the fundamentals in the private sector are solid and they kind of support, you know, the scenario plan out. You know, a lot of concern and certainly among our clients, when we talk to them about debt levels. Debt is a problem in the public sector. It's not necessarily a big problem in the private sector. The private sector overall is in pretty good financial health in aggregate, and that's kind of certainly a potential tailwind for this scenario. The policy front, and I refer specifically in this case to monetary and fiscal policy, this could go either way. So the current status is we have loose fiscal policy, and the current estimates of the deficit could be about 6.5% of GDP for this year. We have monetary policy that is restrictive, debatable how restrictive it is. So the trend would be, well, monetary policy should get easier. The Fed should be cutting rates. But fiscal policy is also constrained by the fact that the deficit is so large, the debt is large. So the assumption would be monetary might get easier, but fiscal could actually get, you know, more restrictive on net. Maybe that, you know, that means a headwind because policy is not quite as supportive. So that's kind of our baseline assumption. But the wild card comes in, like on the fiscal front, there's not a lot of political appetite to curtail deficits. And this is true on both sides of the aisle. So this is not a, you know, kind of one party versus the other. Politically, you know, if it doesn't kind of score points, then you could see deficits staying large for the time being. One implication is then, so fiscal policy is still relatively supportive, but the consequence is that the Fed actually has to get more supportive as well by perhaps cutting interest rates to reduce the overall financing costs. So you get something called fiscal dominance, where monetary policy becomes sort of subservient to the fiscal situation. In that case, you actually have policy that is as stimulative and maybe a little bit more than it is now. So policy then becomes actually a marginal tailwind. So that's kind of where it could be supportive or negative. Ultimately, we think it's probably going to be, you know, kind of a net negative, but maybe not nearly as much. And there's a chance that you can get a situation where, you know, the policy solution to high deficits is high nominal growth. And that would support kind of a roaring 20s outcome.
So with that, Paul, while the 1920s is an obvious economic comparison given the title of the piece, you also go on to compare the current environment to the 1990s some 30 years ago. So why the comparison to the 90s?
Right. If I were to describe an environment where the U.S. economy, where nominal GDP is growing at 5-6%, we just had a soft landing and productivity is accelerating, it can very much describe what we're experiencing now or what the U.S. economy experienced in the mid-90s, specifically the sort of insurance rate cuts in 94, where you had soft landing, productivity growth increasing, and now we have more and more economists and academics saying that there was something going on in productivity thanks to the capital deepening because of a lot of investment for computers, as well as the productivity gains because of that. I think for a lot of us, the financial crisis and the sort of tepid recovery is still much on our minds. Mm-hmm. But based on our assessment on this report, we're saying that the conditions look very much like a more robust environment like the 90s. And with the megatrends that we outlined, we're marginally more confident that this environment can be supported in the medium term.
So with that, Jason, as we begin to close out today, what can investors, our clients, take away from a higher likelihood of a roaring 20s environment?
So again, by saying the roaring 20s regime we're talking about is an economic regime, it's not necessarily a market regime, because people clearly kind of translate to, if it's the 90s, what happened with the dot-com bubble,
right?
The 1920s, you had sort of the bubble popping there. Like whether you get bubbles or not, that's something we can easily forecast. What I would say is that if you get kind of this good growth environment, inflation is, you know, elevated but not contained, interest rates are not too high, that is a good sort of market environment for equities, say, to do well. And so generally directionally positive. Now, keeping in mind, U.S. equities are not cheap right now. So to kind of get a lot more expensive and to do really well, you know, there is the risk that you kind of get these bubbles forming. There's also an element like what part of the markets do well. And so it's not like, you know, kind of rising tide lifts all boats. I mean, there's some of that. But for the steam to play out, we probably have to have AI have implications where you start to see later this decade the productivity benefits, the revenue benefits, which means you can get the scenario, but the real winners in the equity markets might be those companies that are sort of most directly tied to AI. So similar to the 1990s is a tech sector that is the biggest winner. And so that's, if that scenario plays out, chances are this is the way things would happen. Another, just in terms of investing implications, is that if you get kind of higher inflation than we had in the 2010s, kind of the relationships between different asset classes and stocks and bond in particular, you know, changes. Instead of having a negative correlation, maybe they become kind of more positively correlated, at least zero. And so you don't get the diversification benefits in the portfolio like we've experienced for 20 years, which means you'll probably get more portfolio volatility. And you also need to look for other asset classes, in particular kind of alternatives, to give you some of that diversification as well. So it's a good economic backdrop doesn't guarantee a good stock market. You know, they can move separately, although I think, you know, generally directionally it would be supportive. But there can be certainly more winners than other, like kind of the losers in this case. And sort of typical relationships that we did get in the 90s may not be quite as good in terms of like that stock bond relationship. So there's still a reason to think about diversification and looking for alternatives to make sure you're diversified. because even if like we could be right, but if we're wrong, sure, other scenarios could play out. It's almost a hedging your portfolio against multiple scenarios, again, thinking about diversification across all of them.
Well, Jason, Paul, very thought-provoking. Thank you for dropping by the studio to spend some time again with our listeners, our clients, keeping them informed on the latest ongoing conversation. So do look forward to having you both back to continue it.
Thank you very much.
Happy to come back and talk more about the Roar Score trademark.
Trademark, absolutely. Thanks again, guys. Appreciate it. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.